Welcome to the Two Writing Teachers podcast. Two Writing Teachers is a meeting place for a world of reflective writers. Here on the podcast, we are excited to talk about ways to create, lead, and sustain joyful and productive writing workshops. My name is Stacey Schubitz, and I'm here with my colleague Melanie Meehan. Let's work together to inspire and empower students to be competent, brave, and confident writers. Welcome to the Writing Roundtable. I'm thrilled to be joined by Melanie Meehan and Maggie Roberts, authors of the new book, Foundational Skills for Writing, a brain-based guide to strengthen executive functions, language, and other cornerstones for writers. You know Melanie is the co-host of this podcast, but today I'm asking the questions of her and Maggie, whom I've known since our days as students at Teachers College. Both Melanie and Maggie are authors, literacy consultants, and brilliant women whom I'm delighted to have you learn from today. Maggie Roberts began her teaching career in the heart of Chicago, then moved to New York City, where she completed graduate studies as a literacy specialist at Teachers College, Columbia University. She holds post-baccalaureate certification in learning differences in neurodiversity with a specialization in executive function from Landmark College. Maggie is a national literacy consultant, author, and highly sought-after professional learning facilitator. As co-author of DIY Literacy, Teaching Tools for Differentiation, Rigor, and Independence with Kate Roberts, Maggie continues to empower educators with tools that enhance student learning and independence. Her forthcoming book, Unboxing the Curriculum, helps educators and school leaders navigate pre-packaged curriculum and tailor it to students' needs. You don't usually hear our bios as podcast hosts, but since Melanie Meehan is more of a guest today, I want you to hear her bio too. In addition to being a co-author of Two Writing Teachers and co-host here on the podcast, Melanie opened The Writing Clinic, an in-person and online center for inspiring and nurturing competent, confident, and joyful young writers after retiring from her public school position as an elementary curriculum coordinator. Melanie's published works include Every Child Can Write, The Responsive Writing Teacher, and Answers to Your Biggest Questions About Teaching Elementary Writing, all published by Corwin Press. Today, we're discussing her most recent book, co-authored with Maggie, Foundational Skills of Written Expression, which was published in February 2026. Foundational Skills for Writing offers teachers a fresh, insightful approach to understanding how writers develop. Instead of simply describing writing development, the book brings it to life using progressions, look-fors, and charts to help you pinpoint where a student is on their writing journey and to determine the next steps to move them forward. Each chapter opens and closes with real-life case studies, grounding your learning in authentic classroom stories as you explore the book. Throughout the book, conversation with a colleague sections introduce the voices of researchers, service providers, and classroom teachers, creating a sense of professional community. Try It boxes offer practical strategies you can immediately use, bridging theory and practice with clarity and purpose. The Minute Moves provide simple ways to integrate new learning into your students' lives, sometimes as soon as tomorrow. Visually, this book is a standout. Full-color brain illustrations highlight which regions are engaged in each chapter's focus, translating complex cognitive science into tangible, approachable content. The design, featuring Larkin Meehan's artwork, is thoughtfully crafted, drawing you in and making foundational writing skills engaging and accessible for all readers. As you make your way through the book, you may find that your perspective on writing instruction deepens with each chapter. This resource not only informs what you teach, but also shapes how you understand and support the writers in your classroom. So let's dive in with Melanie Meehan and Maggie Roberts as we unpack the foundations of writing and explore what happens in the brain and in the classroom when we teach writers with intention.
Welcome, Maggie. Hello, Melanie.
Hi. Good to be here.
So excited to be here.
I'm happy that you're with me today. There's so much I would love to discuss from your book, but in the interest of time, I want to focus on one part that really caught my attention from the get-go, and that's the conversation with a colleague sections. What motivated you to include these conversations, and what ways do you think it deepens teachers' experience when they're interacting with the book?
When we were researching the book, the voices of the researchers, the occupational therapists, just were ringing in our minds. And we had a moment that I think it was Melanie who said, maybe we just reach out to some of them and see if they'd have a conversation with us, because it just felt like there was such a possibility for conversation stemming from the brilliant research and ideas we stumbled across throughout the process of this book. And, you know, by, you know, creating a text feature out of it, it felt like kind of the best part of an educational conference that you'll go to, where you're in a room and you're in front of a panel and you're kind of pinching yourself. Like, how did I get so lucky to find this panel right here, right now? And so I feel like this section of the text brings a little bit of that conference panel feel right to a busy classroom teacher. And it, you know, helps everybody feel a little less isolated, you know, hearing perspectives from other people that either validates our teaching and our thinking or stretches it, helps it grow and develop. It was a really special feature of the book.
I think just adding on, I would say that one of the takeaways that I hope people have from this book is that there is so much complexity to writing, and the more that you can use the professionals that are in your building, the better. Like, I think that's a really important element of the conversations with colleagues too. Like, go have them and have them before it's a big problem.
Right. Use the experts right in front of you. Totally. So on the podcast, we talk a lot about graphic organizers, and so I was really happy to see a whole section dedicated to them in chapter two. Can you share how graphic organizers can serve as thinking tools? I remember that phrase, especially for students who are struggling with planning and prioritizing.
I'm glad it resonated with you. You know, when we think about what graphic organizers help us do, they help us chunk information and group information and sequence information. And when we do that from the ground up on a blank page of a blank piece of paper, it does take a lot of cognitive energy to think through those categories and those plans and that sequencing. And so by providing those containers to young writers allows them then to direct the limited amount of cognitive energy they might have in that moment, not necessarily to planning and sequencing and prioritizing, but to letting their ideas come from their mind and drift onto the page. And so I think that what graphic organizers can do is it can help take some of the heavy lifting off of a young writer's a plate, and allows them to direct their intention to the art and the craft of composing. That being said, I think that we can explicitly teach kids how to build their own graphic organizers and containers, knowing that that's going to take a lot of energy for a young writer to do. And so it may not be the most strategic lesson to help kids engage in building their own graphic organizers and then say, okay, now let's write your story. They might be out of, you know, cognitive juice by that point. So I think these graphic organizers, when we frame them as thinking tools, is that they are these tools that allow students to engage in the deep work of thinking and problem solving, which is the core and the essence of writing.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I've written about a lot on Two Writing Teachers has to do with graphic organizers and the complicated relationship I have with them. I think there are so many beautiful graphic organizers that are out there, and kids don't need beautiful graphic organizers. Kind of to Maggie's point, they need graphic organizers that work and support their overall executive functioning. And I think that the chapter and writing the chapter and talking about it so much with Maggie really gave me the words that graphic organizers are really for, that overall executive functioning and helping working memory really stay with the writing that they're doing and using that cognitive energy to produce the writing as opposed to remember what they're going to say next.
Right, right. And I don't feel like they're really being used for that purpose in many places. So I was delighted to see that you guys devoted so much time to it in that chapter.
Well, you know, there's that like tension between, is it an assignment or is it really useful for the writer? And I think that's where, if it's just an exercise in filling something out, then it's not necessary. If it's something that is really helpful to the writer in terms of their executive functioning, then it's critically important.
I love that, Melanie. These questions that we can ask ourselves of, what is this graphic organizer? How is it helping a student plan? Mm-hmm. How is it helping the student prioritize? How is it helping the student sequence information and ideas, right? All of those are executive functions that kids have to engage when they are sitting down to dive into a piece of writing. So a little litmus test for teachers to say, like, what exactly is this tool doing for the writer? How is it in service of writing?
I love that. I love that. I want to talk about one of my favorite things, which is conferring. When we're conferring with students, how can we as teachers show more cognitive flexibility in the way that we talk to kids? In the book, you mentioned that certain questions like, what's the theme, can unintentionally box students in. So what are some other ways we can phrase our questions or responses to open up more possibilities for student thinking and writing?
So again, it's something that I've written about a lot with two writing teachers.
You're going to drop all these in the show note link, right?
But it relates to executive functioning again.
Sure.
It's those categories of executive functioning. And this book gave me, again, the words, and Maggie gave me the words because she's so, I mean, we started writing this book because of Maggie's presentation that she was giving in Colorado about neurodiversity and how we can support writers who are neurodivergent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the springboard for this whole book. And so, like, I was doing things, but not naming them and having the intention.
Mm-hmm.
And when we pay attention to cognitive flexibility as one of these subcategories of executive functioning, we open up that kind of questioning of what are other answers. It's not about what's the right answer. It's about what are the different ways that I can do something or the different answers I can give to a question. And everybody needs that these days. There's not one way to do something or one right answer. So,
and I think when we're talking to students and saying, have you thought about framing the opening of the story in this way instead of this way? Almost taking a beat, taking a step back and saying, I'm going to ask you to be a little flexible right now in your thinking. Mm-hmm. And that might feel really easy for you right now, but that also might feel really difficult. And you might even feel a bit resistant to what I'm going to be suggesting that you do as your writing coach. And I think that kind of voiceover that you can do when you're conferring with students, which is, yeah, you know, to be a writer requires a lot of flexibility on your part to really imagine and reimagine and write and let go. And just inviting students into that type of mindset that
like
we have to be flexible.
It.
Yeah, it normalizes it. It sets up the student to have a stance to receive what we're going to be teaching them. And it also engages in conversation, which is like, today actually may not be my most cognitively flexible day. And this may not be the day that I can sit and reimagine how this story is going to go. So I love that, Stacey, connecting the skill of cognitive flexibility with some of our most powerful moments with student writers, which is in conferring, I think is a really nice place to pair that work.
So like the whole conversation just keeps like coming together, because really it's relating to the conversations with colleagues in a way, because it was Nelson Cohen who, when I spoke to him, really talked about the importance of meta memory and teaching kids to know and understand how their memory works, like what's involved in your working memory. Mm-hmm. And as we're talking about that, it's really teaching kids how does your cognitive flexibility work? And how does your inhibitory control work? They actually all relate to graphic organizers, and they relate to conferring and the different ways we can do things. There is so much research about metacognition and how important it is for kids to know and understand how they learn. And this is like a subcategory of metacognition. So the more that we can teach kids about executive functioning and what they can do and how they can help themselves and work together, the better. And it's so important for writing, because writing really is as complex of an activity as human beings do.
Yeah. I want to keep moving through the book. It's such a rich book, and there's so much in there, and we could be here for hours, but we're not going to do that. So I'm going to move into chapter 4 now. And you explain that gross motor development comes before fine motor skills. Big movements are laying the foundation for smaller ones, like writing. So that's something that many educators might not consider. Can you talk about why it's so important for teachers to understand this connection, especially when supporting early writers or kids who struggle with handwriting or a little bit older?
Absolutely. So, you know, I invite you for a moment to kind of go into your own personal time machine and mm-hmm. go back in time, if maybe you're a third grade teacher, to go back in time a little bit. And imagine your third graders as 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, and all of the moments of big movement in early childhood, whether that is moving heavy rocks from one side of the river to the other side of the river, or jumping or folding. You also might consider that there may be limits of that big body movement that some of your kids had. You know, in the research of this book, there were many times that I would be facilitating conversations and listening sessions with early childhood educators when looking at the scope of their career, how they have noticed that some of those big body movements and play and development is less accessible and available to young children. And mm-hmm. so if we do see a third grader struggling, let's say, with handwriting, it's interesting to kind of go back in time and even imagine or even potentially ask questions about, you know, what activities did you do in preschool, in kindergarten? Mm-hmm. And that if there wasn't as much, you know, big body movement as there could have been, that it's never too late to start to incorporate a movement and whole body exercises into a child's life, knowing mm-hmm. that when kids are engaged in those gross motor skills, that is neurodevelopmentally laying patterns for the small motor skill development that kids desperately need and hold on to when they are handwriting or keyboarding.
Julie Booth, in one of the conversations with a colleague, was the physical therapist who really laid it out there about mm-hmm. how kids who are falling off their chairs or slumping are really going to have a hard time, and you're going to see them have behavioral issues. And oftentimes those behavioral issues will happen during writing, because it's just too much cognitive energy to be putting into doing this little tedious skill, and they mm-hmm. don't have it. Like it's easier to just fall off their chair.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as a follow-up, also in that chapter, I really love the walk a paragraph and walk an essay ideas that you shared. Those were so new to me. Could you share that here so that people have an idea of like how that gross motor, big motor, what did you call it in the book? Was it large motor?
large motor
scale. We call them large motor scales, mm-hmm. but it was always a conversation.
Okay, yeah, I was looking at it. I'm like, oh, that's gross motor.
It can be large motor scales. It can be gross motor scales. It can be big muscle scales. Whatever. We're talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. But can you share that with our listeners just so they can like have a little sense of how this might go in a classroom?
Yes. So this work stems from a brilliant professor at Landmark College who really connected movement with planning. So what I mean by that is that, you know, when we're thinking about planning a paragraph, that's spatial work. Mm-hmm. And another form of spatial work is movement. And so this professor was really coaching her students to say, okay, we're going to be planning a paragraph. And what I want you to do is get up out of your chairs. And as you think about the topic of your paragraph and the topic sentence that you might write for your paragraph, I want you to walk in one direction as you speak that topic sentence out loud. Mm-hmm. When you come to the end of that topic sentence, you're going to be putting on a supporting sentence, right? Because our whole mm-hmm. goal here is to write a paragraph, but you're not going to be writing in this, you're not going to be walking in the same direction as your topic sentence. You're going to actually pivot and walk a different direction because it's a different kind of sentence. Mm-hmm. And you can see students building out their body paragraphs with their physical bodies.
Amazing.
Because in both ways, you're tapping into spatial planning. You get the extra bonus and added kick of connecting movement with learning, mm-hmm. which we know from the research, as we pair movement with learning something new, that helps solidify that new learning and help kids form knowledge. So whether you're walking a paragraph or even walking an essay, those can be two ways to help kids engage in movement, both as in their spatial planning skills, but also to help them really remember what they are trying to write.
They also really love it. They're just like giggling and happy doing it, and it sticks. Like, I've just done it a lot since we've been writing and working and talking about doing this. So,
can you just say a little bit about Landmark College, Maggie? Like, I have a friend from high school who went there, and I cannot say enough about it based on him and everything I've learned about it from him. But I think that's important for people to know when they're listening to this.
Yes. Yeah, so, Landmark College is based in Vermont. And it is a undergraduate college space that specializes in a neurodivergent student body. Mm-hmm. So students with ADHD, autism, dyslexia, OCD, all faculty are trained and knowledgeable about how to tailor learning and create learning experiences for a neurodiverse population. And I only learned about it when I was getting my post-baccalaureate certification in executive functioning and neurodiversity. And mm-hmm. it offers summer classes for educators. It offers certificates, and it's an incredible community to both learn and contribute to.
Moving along into chapter 5, you write that when small motor skills are underdeveloped, students may struggle with handwriting legibility, fatigue, or even reluctance to write. We all can picture certain kids in our minds as, mm-hmm. you know, I say that. Later in the chapter, you offer activities for tweens and teens to build those skills. For our listeners who work with older students facing these challenges, can you share a few of your favorite activities from that part of the book?
I can share a few. I have some students who I've been working with who are older students struggling with fine motor skills. Step-by-step drawing involves the visual motor integration that handwriting also involves. It involves connecting lines to certain places in space and really coordinating how those lines go. And it has a kind of immediate feedback of how does my picture look. So that is a really nice way to get kids practicing fine motor skills and the visual motor integration it takes to coordinate them. They love it and it works.
And, you know, I remember when my children were in kindergarten, their kindergarten teacher would break out these morning tubs, morning tubs filled with Legos and blocks and, you know, different kinds of activities to help kids with their small motor skill development. But if we think about taking that concept to the older students, having a 500-piece puzzle set up and just going in the back of your classroom, or doing, you know, asking for contributions and donations of Lego sets and having an ongoing Lego build. You know, the more analog, the better, you know, collages, making vision boards or bullet journaling. Lots of ways that we can invite older students to be in the material of their own learning. Even clay are all ways that kids can practice and strengthen and refine their small motor skills.
Yeah, as I was reading that part of the book, I was like, yeah, I think teens and tweens would totally go for these activities. Like, they're realistic.
There is that tension throughout the book of, was it a book that was for young children, or was it a book that was bridging older students and moving in toward middle school? And the more research I came across, the more I was like, this is really important for older students too. Handwriting and writing notes is something that is really important for memory and for learning. It's not, we as humans do better at handwriting in order to remember and learn and develop thoughts and ideas than we do as keyboarding. So that's,
I mean, I've really gone from using my phone to using this type of list.
Yes.
I'm showing them my very large to-do list. And it classifies by urgency. So I can see it, but I see it all the time. I don't have to look at my phone. Right. So you know that I believe handwriting is important. I always have. I always will. There are some administrators who are going to be listening to this who might be thinking, we don't really have time for explicit handwriting lessons anymore because we have so many other literacy priorities, or priorities that aren't literacy also. Given what you share in this chapter about daily direct instruction and modeling, what would you say to those leaders about why handwriting still matters and deserves intentional time in grades K through three?
I mean, to build off of what Melanie was just saying, I think it's really framing handwriting as a modality for learning. That when I engage in handwriting, when I prioritize it in my schedule and my instruction, I am prioritizing learning. In our research, we found multiple studies showing how when we engage in handwriting, we are engaging more networks in our brain than just keyboarding or typing. When we handwrite, it helps us encode information, whether we are encoding spelling or building knowledge. And because it is a tool that facilitates learning, if I'm constantly thinking about how to handwrite something, it's going to get in the way of that learning. And so the reason we want to prioritize it throughout the day and throughout the week through instruction and modeling and practice is that so kids can build some automaticity with that skill, which basically means they can engage in handwriting without thinking, how am I holding my pencil? What pressure am I, you know, using on this tool? How do I form the letter D? Melody, take it from there.
I was just like laughing because it's like, which way does that B go? B, like, D. But, you know, we went down the older kid lane, and that one's super important. There's also, as kids are learning to read, there's a huge body of research that talks about the importance of handwriting and letter formation in terms of orthographic mapping and understanding the whole phonological codes. And the more that we talk to them about letters and relate those letters to the sounds, mm-hmm. the stronger those orthographic connections happen. And yep. so it really is a pathway for learning to read that isn't as well-trodden as maybe it should be. Mm-hmm. So it serves both. I think as you think about handwriting, and this was really helpful as we wrote the book, was thinking about the three different categories to think about it. And mm-hmm. Maggie really alluded to it in terms of, like, you have like the letter formation, and right. we talk about that a lot. But you also have the automaticity and the fluency.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to be thinking about how good is are all of those systems, and where do I need to really jump in and nudge students? There's reasons and ways to assess any one of those three categories, and that's super important to pay attention to as well.
Yep.
As I was reading, I saw something about time transcription, which you know it has a significant impact. Like, can you talk a little bit more about yes. that, like the targeting of the speed and the accuracy?
Yes. So when we look at, you know, timed transcription, almost looking at it as a handwriting intervention that can target speed and fluency and accuracy, what we're talking about are, like, for example, alphabet or word sprints, mm-hmm. where you would put a minute on the clock and time kids to form correct letters or spell high frequency words, and you're prioritizing accuracy first and then mm-hmm. speed. Kids can track their personal bests mm-hmm. as these alphabet or word sprints kind of evolve across the week or weeks. And you want to pair it with just a little bit of feedback or a small goal, like next time, let's start at the midline with this letter.
And I think that's a great point about just like tucking in like a tip for the next time. So it's not just, you know, kids practicing and feeling like, well, it was another time test. Next I'll have multiplication or whatever exactly. it is. It actually has some meaning.
Mm-hmm. And they have a record almost, yeah. right? You can imagine the record then kids have to say, oh, look, you know, if I'm doing alphabet sprints, it's like, look at how my letter formation is improving mm-hmm. Across this series of timed transcriptions. I mean,
looking at it from the letter formation lens, I have a student who, like every 2 or 3 weeks, we write the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. And mm-hmm. that is a sentence that they use for typography because it contains all of the letters in the English language. But he loves looking at it and being like, oh, look, I made my E right this time. And I can do my that. Z. Like, he can kind of look at it and be like, I didn't put the capital F. I got the lower.
There case. You go. Mm-hmm.
Like, he's seeing the growth and really having a fun time doing that. So it doesn't take long and it doesn't need to feel super tedious, and it can feel really purposeful, and kids get it. Like, they understand.
Yeah. Moving into chapter 7, that felt like both a master class and a crash course on spelling. I had to go and go to bed afterwards because I learned so much in that chapter. One thing that really stood out was the predictable progressions that you outlined. Could you highlight how teachers can apply the phonological, orthographic, and morphological progressions that you shared in that chapter?
We tried to divide it. Again, this was almost for our brains and organizing the chapter as much as for readers' brains. It was
actually, I felt that as a fellow author, I was like, I can see the organizational structure and why they did it this way. So yeah. Well done, in my opinion.
Thanks. It was a lot.
Yeah.
But I think as I use it, we have those three different progressions, but we've also overlapped the progressions. So like as kids are developing their phonological knowledge mm-hmm. and their understanding of letters and sounds and how they go together, kind of in conjunction with their phonemic awareness, there's also that understanding of morphology that has to happen. And I think Rebecca Triman, who is the conversation we had with a colleague, has really beautiful articles pointing out that you can't really understand and spell certain words without understanding morphology. And there, I think that seeing the overlap and talking about it was just really, really helpful for us as writers, and I hope for readers, and for how we teach kids and make it make sense, because spelling is such a complicated task that brains do.
Yeah. And if you're thinking about it as, you know, almost like buckets or systems, you know, as a practitioner, viewing a child's spelling through the lens of phonology, are they hearing the sounds? Viewing the child's spelling through orthography, viewing the child's spelling through morphology, I then can almost get intel and direction for my own teaching of what system is strongest and that this child is really leaning on heavily to spell this word, and where could I direct my teaching? Because, you know, when a child is struggling with spelling or engaging in some spelling mistakes, if we can look at this not just as a whole kind of monolith, they can't spell versus those three categories, I think it can be really generative and directional for our teaching.
I find myself using it all the time with students I'm working with and talking to them about whether it is the orthography and the different letter patterns that exist and how they can recognize them. Like, is it an expected letter pattern or is it a more advanced letter pattern and why? And talking to them about the morphology, it was almost like as I think back on this conversation and how Maggie gave me words for what I did as far as executive functioning is concerned, it's really powerful to give kids the words to talk about spelling and to think about, I like, here is the suffix and the prefix that I need to know and the morphology that goes with the shun that is driving me crazy at the end of a word. It helps it make sense for kids who might need a couple additional exposures than other kids do. And that's really helpful. It's also really helpful for kids to know and think about and understand that there are systems in the brain that help work their way through to make words not be so to not demand that level of work to spell. Like you get to a point where you just automatically spell. And I have a student who I work with who is like, oh, like that one's going into my visual word form area now.
Oh, wow.
It's so cool.
Yeah. You want
put it
you
in
want
there. That. Go.
Put it in there. File it away. There's enough in the leveraging literacy section of your final chapter on syntax and sentence construction to fill several episodes. But before we wrap up, can you talk a little bit about sentence combining? That was a big takeaway for me from this chapter.
That's really great to hear. Yeah, I felt the same way. You know, sentence combining, you know, we want to tether that work to Bruce Sadler. I'm going to start, let's say, with a kernel sentence, a simple sentence with just a noun and a verb. And I might give students two kernel sentences, such as the ice cream was delicious and the ice cream was strawberry. And then I might pose it to the students. We got to take those two kernel sentences, combine them into a popcorn sentence. Mm-hmm. And Sadler would suggest that you might even start with a Q and underline the word strawberry, mm-hmm. so that the student kind of knows and has a visual cue of what word from one kernel sentence might get harvested and put into the other kernel sentence. Mm-hmm. But this work can expand into giving kids two simple sentences like the dog barks, the cat sleeps, and we invite students to say, what are all the different ways we could combine those sentences? And students will have a lot of fun with it. You know, like initially they'll say something like, you know, the dog barks and the cat sleeps, but they'll quickly move into the dog barks, but the cat sleeps, or although the dog barks, the cat sleeps, and it becomes really playful. And all of a sudden you are working playfully with conjunctions and different ways to combine sentences. We had a lot of fun with that section.
It's kind of a nice full circle in this conversation to go back to that cognitive flexibility thing of like, there's not a right answer to it. There's all these different ways of doing it. Like, what are some of the different ways that you can combine these words and make it a single sentence? So it's kind of a fun thing to think about.
And again, it could take just a few minutes, right? I think the big, you know, thing is that there are lots and lots and lots of ideas in this book. But one guiding light that Melanie and I tried to follow was, can we contextualize this work in small strategies, activities, and exercises that teachers can embed in the minutes they have available that can take writers a long distance?
I think you succeeded in that, because there were so many of like the minute moves and other things that I was like, oh yeah, this can fill that, you know, 10 minutes of dead time after lunch, or this can be put in, you know, during a transition. I mean, there were so many ways that the ideas in this book can be used. I said it in the beginning, I'll say it again. I feel like I would have been a much better teacher of writers had I had this information 22 years ago when I started out. I mean, this is really going to be a book that people are going to reference and should reference. So Maggie, thank you so much for joining us today. Melanie, it's been nice to have you as a guest instead of as a co-host today. For both of you, your practical insights and advice are going to really make a difference for teachers and writers alike. And I know I will be returning to your book, both as a literacy consultant and in my work supporting accessible education. For listeners, I've included a link to Foundational Skills for Writing, a brain-based guide to strengthen executive functions, language, and other cornerstones for writers in the show notes. The book is available now from Corwin Press or your favorite independent bookstore.
Thank you so much, Stacey.
Thank you for listening to the Two Writing Teachers podcast. Check out the show notes for links to the items we mentioned in this episode, as well as ways to connect with us. For more about the teaching of writing, head over to the Two Writing Teachers blog at twowritingteachers.org. If you liked what you heard today, please share it with your friends and colleagues, post about it on social media, like, subscribe, and leave us ratings and reviews. Our music is by Lemon Music Studio. If you'd like to connect with us, email us at contact@twowritingteachers.org. Thanks again for listening. Let's teach, learn, and write on together.